Imagine waking up in a foreign country and not being able to communicate properly with those around you. Imagine then that this was not simply about having the particular words, but a complete inability to communicate to others what's on your mind. Imagine the sense of frustration you would get and the isolation you'd feel as people got frustrated with you. Well, this is actually a reality for many people here in Ireland, people who've actually grown up in this country. The ability to communicate is fundamental to leading a satisfactory life, and people with speech and language difficulties know this all too well. But the ever-developing profession of speech and language therapy helps hundreds of people every day in this country to overcome these barriers, and we've invited some practitioners in the field to talk to us about this fascinating area. Margaret Leahy is a senior lecturer in speech and language therapy at Trinity College in Dublin. Aoife Hayden is a child speech and language therapist in Ballantyre Health Centre in Dublin. Celia Nicol is from the Irish Association of Speech and Language Therapists. And finally, Yvonne Fitzmaurice is a speech and language therapist at Royal Hospital in Donnybrook. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Yvonne, you're a practitioner in the field and you work with adults. What kind of adults need speech therapy, speech and language therapy? And, you know, brutally, is the scenario I just outlined, is that a bit extreme or is it a regular occurrence?
I don't think it's at all extreme. I would come across people living with severe communication difficulties during the course of my work every day. Working in the Royal Hospital Dublin, or in Donnybrook, I see people who have acquired a speech and language difficulty or a swallowing difficulty as a result of sudden onset neurological conditions such as stroke or traumatic brain injury, or due to other neurological conditions such as Parkinson's disease, MS, motor neuron disease, and dementia. And the type of difficulty you see every day can vary dramatically depending on the severity of the disorder. So it can be very, very mild, where a person can have, let's say, word-finding difficulties. You know, we've all experienced those, everybody. Something's on the tip of your tongue.
Yeah.
You're trying to think of a name, or, you know, an actor or a place, and you just can't get it, and you eventually do. So I suppose the people I deal with did be dealing with that in every conversation, all day, every day, okay? And that can be at its mildest form. And then the scenario you describe, you know, waking up in a foreign country, there are people who, particularly, you know, as a result of stroke, could be multilingual one day. And the next day, it's as dramatic as this, they cannot... they've lost their ability to communicate.
Intellectually, like it's all in, all the information is in there.
Intellectually, they're
just
perfectly
can't get
sound,
out.
Yes. A communication difficulty does not impair your intellectual abilities, your abilities to make decisions for yourself, your abilities to reason.
But is this kind of physiological, where something actually, you know, happens to your physique, happens to your body, or is it in the mind and needs kind of gentle coaxing out, or does it vary?
Specifically
with somebody with strokes.
People I would deal with stroke, it's more they experience difficulties as a result to damage to the areas of the brain responsible for control of language function. And depending on the area and the extent of the damage in that area, they will have differing symptoms. Okay, that's with stroke. For example, some people, the disorder you can have a speech disorder where a person may have no speech at all, but also may have quite a lot of speech, but the speech can be somewhat unintelligible or unclear. It can be perceived, for example, as slurred, which is very typical for people with motor neuron disease with multiple sclerosis. Yeah. You could have speech of very low volume.
But how do you actually address these then? And I want to talk about brain injury as well, but I mean, how exactly do you address these particular conditions that you've talked about? In brief now, because I imagine that the therapies are very, very complex in many ways.
Very complex and very varied, yes. So in brief, you can work with the person who has the communication difficulty to improve things like comprehension, things like speech production, things like speech intelligibility. You do a very comprehensive assessment and then tailor your specific intervention to suit that individual. But also, very importantly, an acquired communication difficulty can be a lifelong and life-altering disability. It not only affects the person experience the difficulty, but expect everybody around them.
Absolutely, their families.
You said that, you know, intelligence is preserved, but your ability to do the most mundane of things, such as read the newspaper,
I want to go to the other end, because Aoife, you actually work with children, and am I right in saying that a child, there are typical ages, there are typical stages of development a child should be at any particular, whether they're 2 or whether they're 4, 6, 5, 7, whatever, and that's how you see what, that's how you assess whether somebody has actually a speech or language difficulty.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a kind of a developmental range of where you expect children to be at. From the very beginning, when children are born, they are almost starting to communicate through gesture and through facial expression, through smiling. And when a child comes into us, we look at their overall communication development in a similar way to Yvonne was speaking about there. We look at their understanding, at their ability to express themselves through language, at the clarity of their speech. And depending on what age they are, we obviously assess whether they're doing what they should be doing or whether they seem to be significantly delayed. Because obviously there's a wide range of normal as well, you know, and a wide range of what we might expect. And children will vary in many ways. But we can identify when actually they are experiencing a communication difficulty and when it is above and beyond what would be expected.
And why might a child, say a young child, be, what are the range of conditions, for example, that would see a child experiencing speech and language difficulties?
Sure. In fact, a lot of the time we don't know why they're experiencing communication or a speech or language difficulty. There are certain things we can identify and say, for example, a hearing difficulty, a child who's not hearing properly for whatever reason, you know, because of fluid in the ear or because of a sensory neural hearing loss, that will obviously impact on their communication.
Oh, so it'd be as simple as that.
It could be as simple as that. Or it could be something much more kind of overarching and more global, like an overall learning difficulty or something like the an autistic spectrum disorder. But in fact, in most cases, in most children that I see, we never actually identify what the cause was.
Yeah.
And in fact, in many cases, we don't necessarily need to know what it was in order to facilitate the progress of their communication.
Because a lot of people would have very obvious physical disability, for example, cerebral palsy, and their speech would be affected. But you're saying you could have somebody who is absolutely perfectly healthy on the outside.
Absolutely.
And for some reason, words just aren't coming
absolutely
out.
Absolutely. And, you know, in fact, in working in a community care clinic with children who are attending us, who aren't attending specialist services such as Enable Ireland or something along those lines, they, in most cases, have nothing obvious wrong with them, and their development in every other way is often perfectly normal, and their cognitive ability is often fine as well.
How many children are we talking about? If it's that range of condition, how many would we many children per 100 or whatever would we possibly be talking about?
About 10%, I think. Okay. Celia here is
Celia.
Yeah, I suppose research has shown that about 10% of all children would have some form of communication difficulty. Now, that could range from mild to severe and from simple to complex. But just as a general figure, it's taken that 10% of children will have some form of communication difficulty that might impede their ability to access, say, education or their ability to make relationships with others.
You're from the association, just a reminder, the Association of Irish Association of Speech and Language
That's
Therapists.
Right.
It's quite a new discipline, isn't it, speech and language therapy? Relatively.
Relatively new. I suppose it's been in Ireland for about 50 years.
Would I be right in saying that, Margaret?
1969, the course was set up. 1969. Yeah. And Margaret, as you're there, you're a senior lecturer in speech and language therapy in Trinity College. Mm. Can I just add, one of the first questions I asked was around the whole frustration issue. And just from the point of view of adults and children, is that sense of frustration felt across the board when people can't get the words out?
A sense of frustration might be part of the impact of the problem, but there is a wide range of psychosocial responses, I think, to speech and language difficulties. Just on the earlier point that Celia was making, you know, 10% of children would have some kind of speech-language communication problem. I just wanted to tie it in with the notion that, as Aoife demonstrated, it's not necessarily in any sense medical or related to particular kinds of causes. And it really, I suppose, opens up the issue of speech and language therapists working in education, working in schools, and that possibility. But to look at the impact of it, I mean, children who can't make themselves easily understood are certainly going to have certain kinds of, well, frustration might be one word, but they can become very agitated by it as well. They can give up in some instances and withdraw somewhat.
So there's a huge behavioural manifestation then.
Yes, yeah. And it's not only the child, it will affect the family as well. It will affect the whole interaction, or can affect the interaction in the family. And depending on the kind of problem, I work in stuttering, for example. Children can, and adults, can really feel deep frustration because of the impact of the problem, because people regard them as being stupid, for example, when they're in no sense stupid or inadequate in certain kinds of ways. I think one of the easiest things to change in behaviour, particularly if you have a kind of speech problem that's not easy to change, would be nonverbal communication, so as that you can get somebody to focus on where they're looking when they're talking, so as that they're able to give messages about listening, for example, or focusing attention on one particular person, or turn-taking, for example, which would be signalled with gaze, where you're looking and so on.
Is this back? Could a speech impairment, or I'm not sure if the speech impairment is the right word, but a speech and language difficulty, yeah. Could it go back to, like, say, a psychological trauma or some kind of psychological condition in a child's past?
I'm sure it's certainly possible. In the work that I'm doing, that's not something that I would typically see. There wouldn't tend to be one discrete event that caused it. And generally, the children that I would see would present first at a very early age, at perhaps 2 or 2.5, when it's become evident that they simply haven't started to use words. And it's one of those milestones that's really important to families. You know, grannies and aunties and people will always ask, you know, has he started walking and has he started talking?
Has he said mama? Has he said a word?
Mama. And so for a family as well as for a child, it's very distressing when, you know, they hit 1.5 and they haven't said anything, and then it's 2, and then people start to get a little bit worried at that stage and become worried that it is, you know, an indicator of something greater than just a language difficulty.
Celia, is there somewhere that, say, a parent, because 1 in 10 strikes me as an extraordinarily high figure, is there anywhere where people can actually get for example, some kind of an indication about where their child should be, or is it really down to a parent kind of, you know, instinctively or intuitively saying, I think my child should be expressing themselves a little bit more?
Sure, yeah. Well, actually, the parent's opinion of where their child is at is very important, and it would be taken very seriously by, say, their public health nurse. That would probably be their first port of call. A public health nurse would visit the child from birth and would give advice on general development, and they would advise them if they felt there was something wrong with, in their movement or their coordination or indeed their speech and language. And then they might advise that they would contact the speech and language therapist. Most speech and language therapists are employed by the health services and work in community care clinics. So that's would probably be people's first contact with their speech and language therapist. Now, in most cases, I think I'm right in saying that parents can refer themselves. They can just ring up their local health centre and ask to be put on the speech and language therapy waiting list.